hearings for today in Senate Committee on Commerce. Unfortunately, we're starting with some technical difficulties. What I mean by that, we've just been informed that we have one of our recorders is not recording. So we have one tape that's going that goes for 30 minutes. I don't think we can take care of all of our business in 30 minutes, but if you think about as you're giving testimony, lease is brief. It means we get more time on the tape, and we'll see how much we can get through today. With that said, let's go ahead and get started with the public hearing. I'm going to open the public hearing on 616. And Anna, why don't you give us an overview on that one?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 616 invalidates a non-competition agreement if an employee is laid off. It has a dash one amendment and a dash two amendment. Do you want me to speak to those, Mr. Chair? Time, or do you want to just go?
Let's hold off on those right now because I'm not sure what the dash one and dash two, if they're actually going to be part of the bill. And we'll go ahead and let the presenter of the bill to come forward, and that's going to be Commissioner Dan Gardner. And Mr. Gardner, if the dash one and dash twos are going to be proposed as being incorporated in your in the bill, then why don't you give us a brief overview of those, and so we'll have something on the record, and we'll probably be coming back to this later.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dan Gardner, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. And with regards to the dash one and the dash two amendments, Mr. Chair, I'm certainly in favor of both. The first one, the dash one, simply says that when you've got someone particularly moving from out of area, potentially even out of state, they have to be notified of a non-compete at the time of notification. The dash twos deal with employee lists and employee client lists and not being able, when you leave, not being able to take those client lists and try to move to a different company and take those clients from your previous employer. Senate Bill 616, this bill, if passed, just really clarifies non-competition agreements that are unenforceable if the employee loses their job as a result of an economic layoff. In addition, the dash one, as I said, clarifies that a prospective employee of a non-compete, if it's required as a condition of employment. Basically, if you look at non-competition agreements from around the country, over here to my right is an enforceability index. It's amazing what you can find when you search the internet. And there are grids that show you on what are the states that are most and least enforceable on non-competition agreements. The state of Oregon is the fifth highest in enforceability of non-competition agreements. This bill really is a small incremental change. This bill simply defines that if you're laid off through no fault of your own, that a non-competition agreement cannot be enforced. Laid off means a permanent termination of an employee relationship for reasons that are beyond the employee's control and do not reflect discredit upon the employee, and reasons for layoff can be include but are not limited to the elimination of the position, lack of available funding for the job, reduction in the size of workforce, changes in the workforce that affect the staffing position. As I said, Oregon is, there are only five states that have a higher enforceability than the state of Oregon. Clearly, the one industry that uses non-competitions greatly is the electronics industry. I'd point out that the states of Texas and California, the highest electronic states in the nation, outlaw non-competition clauses entirely. What we find is that these are highly trained professionals that end up signing these non-competition agreements, and in order to obtain employment, they then find themselves in the unattainable situation where the employment relationship ends, that they have to end up working either out of state or in a totally different profession. Let me give you just five quick examples, and there are letters from these individuals in your packets. Dr. Robert Shannon, an orthopedic surgeon from Bend, had to leave home, his family, and his patients and find a job that didn't interfere with the non-competition agreement. Georgia Norgren, a physical therapist, was forced to leave Oregon altogether in order to find suitable employment. John Sweet, nearing the end of his career as a regional manager for Par Lumber, he went without work, having to turn down two offers of employment in non-related work, as a prospective employer didn't want to tangle with Par over the non-competition agreement. Eventually, he took a job at lower pay that forced him to postpone his pending retirement. In addition, there's articles in the Ben Bulletin about Paige Webster, a spokeswoman for the Oregon Medical Association, that said the organization discourages the use of non-competition because it believes they could potentially to reduce options for patients if physicians, particularly in rural areas, are forced out of town by such a contract. My opinion, this is a fundamental question of fairness. The key element here is a matter of reasonableness. As we're telling our young people, the way to a family wage job is education. They go out, they get educated into a career, and find themselves in a situation where they're signing these non-competition agreements where for an extended period of time they cannot work in their chosen profession. You know, it's, you know, some people talk about trade secrets. Trade secrets are covered under federal law and already taken care of. Some people talk about client lists. The Dash 2 amendments take care of that. You know, I firmly believe if the Silicon Valley, California, and Texas can totally outlaw non-competition agreements, but the Silicon Forest here in Oregon can simply eliminate them for situations where an employee is laid off. Therefore, I urge your support of Senate Bill 616 and be happy to answer any questions.
All right, thank you. Any questions for the commissioner?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Monroe.
Yeah, Dan, what would prevent the employer in that situation where there was an agreement firing the employee instead of just laying him off?
Mr. Chair, Senator Monroe, one, being a conscionable employer, they wouldn't do such a thing. If they are, in fact, a conscionable employer. I mean, I've heard this said before, and it's just not the right thing to do to fire someone. They could end up being taken to court for wrongful termination if they fire them, in fact, for that reason. And I simply think that most employers would not go there being conscionable.
All right. Any other questions? Commissioner, thank you very much. All right. And we're going to be moving... Okay, I'm going to call up a panel of individuals that are listed based on the way they were signed up, and that's going to be Lori DeMarcia. Please come forward. John Sanderfer and Jan Womack.
Would you like copies?
If you give them to the staff, he'll get them distributed to us. Thank you. Thank you. Lori, I'm going to let you go first since you were first on the list.
Okay. Thank you very much. I may speak a little quickly, so if I do, give me a hand.
That's fine.
Okay. I'm submitting this to you with great interest and support.
First, we need you to just say your name for the record.
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Lori DeMarchuk. I'm a physical therapist.
Thank you.
Okay. The Honorable Floyd Prozanski, and Chairman, Senate Commerce Committee. I'm submitting this to you with great interest and in support of Senate Bill 616. I recently had a crash course in employment and labor law in Central Oregon and hope that my experience can be of use to you in considering whether to approve this bill. Let me relate to you some of the particulars of my situation. I've been a practicing therapist for 16 years. I have a specialty in outpatient orthopedics, and I've practiced in Arizona, California, and most recently Oregon. I was suspended indefinitely on November 16th of 2006 after a 3.5-year working relationship. I was pulled aside in the middle of the workday with patients scheduled to see me and was told to leave promptly with the main reason given that management did not like the way I worked with other team members. Oregon, as you know, is an at-will state, which means you can be terminated for no reason at all. My financial responsibilities required that I file for unemployment benefits. When the specialist at the Oregon Employment Department asked me when I was to return to full-time work, I told her I didn't know. She thought this was odd, as most people are suspended for 4 or 5 days and then return to full-time work. Upon further investigation, my status changed from suspension to indefinite suspension. My employer was not willing to give me full-time work, but said there's a possibility of work in the future. Being restricted by the non-compete agreement, I was unable to apply for full-time openings in outpatient physical therapy with other companies in Bend at that time. I then called the Bureau of Labor and Industries for assistance regarding the correct action to take. The representative in Boley's Eugene office said, Org is an at-will state. I can be terminated for no reason at all. My employer can suspend me indefinitely, and because I signed a non-compete agreement, it is enforceable. I could not believe what I was hearing. I felt like an indentured servant. I realize that you're, should I continue? I realize we're short on time.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, if you want to summarize, and I apologize not making this statement at the beginning for everyone.
Okay.
If you have written testimony, we will go through that on our own. And what we'd like to hear from your heart as to how, you know, you either support or oppose the bill.
Okay.
And you, I think you've given us the framework as to how it's impacted you. So if there's something else you'd like to summarize, that would be wonderful.
Yes, I'd just like to summarize that. I would commend Commissioner Gardner for proposing this bill, and thank you for your consideration. I would propose that you consider further amendment to this bill that would void all non-compete clauses in the event an employee is terminated by their employer. This is a matter of common sense. If an employee chooses to leave, a non-compete clause may be appropriate. However, if an employer lays off an employee or suspends them indefinitely, the professional's financial livelihood can suffer greatly for no justified reason. The professional has a right to attempt a livelihood in their chosen profession. If their conduct and skill are such that a termination is warranted, it is unlikely they will be hired by another employer. Thank you for your time taken to read this letter.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for traveling to share your testimony. John?
Oh, thank you. Mr. Chair and Senators, thank you for the time. My name is John Sandifer. I serve as the Executive Director of the Northwest Region of AFTRA, the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists. We represent about 70,000 broadcasters, most of whom are on-air types appearing before the camera or microphone and are heavily involved with non-compete clauses. There was a testimony in Tennessee recently on a similar bill in which one of the witnesses made the point that the non-compete clause is the industry equivalent of your girlfriend dumping you and then telling you not to date anyone else. In the broadcast industry, a large percentage of on-air employees are signed to various forms of individual employment agreements. We call them PSCs, or personal services contracts. And more than 90% of those agreements contain non-compete clauses, which we find are always out of balance in favor of the employer, and often grossly unfair. Non-compete agreements in our industry used to be reserved only for the highest paid news, weather, and anchor talent. That's just not true anymore. Today, they cover practically every employee, including low pay, very early entry-level workers as a condition of employment. There's no real rationale for non-compete clauses at all in our industry. There are no trade secrets. There are no protectable interests, really. They really ought to be banned in their entirety. But the bill before you moves, I think, in the right direction. There have been numerous instances in which we have seen employees held to non-compete clauses after having been fired by their employers. I have seen employees bargain away their severance pay in order to get out of a non-compete clause. And the reason is because they are left with so few choices. The alternative is staying out of work in your chosen profession for a long period of time, changing careers, and you must know how difficult that would be, or uprooting the family and moving out of range, often devastating to family finances. One of the worst non-competes I've seen was involved a television anchor woman in a television station in Yakima, Washington. Her non-compete clause prohibited her from working for any radio, television, or cable outlet in the entirety of Eastern Washington for a period of 3 years, whether she quit or was fired. And for this, she was given the amazing remuneration of $1.32 per hour. Metro traffic reporters, these are the young people you hear delivering traffic reports on radio, routinely start at about $8.42 an hour, and they are required as a condition of employment to sign a one-year non-compete clause, which means they cannot work for anyone else after they lose their jobs for any reason. A television reporter in Seattle last year was terminated when the station just said he didn't meet their standards. They didn't want him on the staff. But they told him they would hold him to a non-compete clause. I thought he asked a very reasonable question. If I'm not good enough for them, why would they want to prevent me from working for someone else? Fortunately, Washington State, where I live, has changed its law in 2002, very similar to what is before you. It voids non-compete clauses when an employee is terminated without cause. So this is a step in the right direction, and we certainly support the bill before you.
Thank you. And Jan.
Thank you. My name is Jan Womack, and I'm going to be presenting testimony on behalf of my husband, who is a victim of a non-compete agreement. He was laid off by his employer for no other reason than they were experiencing difficulties, had to close numerous of their locations, and they closed his shop location here in Salem, merged it with their location in Kaiser, and laid off some of the staff that was at his location. You have the written testimony from him, and essentially what occurred is he's been working in the printing industry for over 30 years. He was a highly productive manager for LaserQuick. When they went through reorganization last year, they closed his operation and laid him off, as well as laying off managers in several of their other locations in Oregon. And due to the non-compete agreement that he had to sign more than 5 years before he initially started working for them, he is not able to work for any other printer within 10 miles of the closest LaserQuick location. They threatened to sue him for even working in the back room doing production work, not even working face-to-face with customers. So he went to work in a company's office in McMinnville and is having to drive back and forth to McMinnville every day. He's not being allowed to work where he lives. And what we see as the advantage to this bill is for people like him who were laid off due to no other reason than a workforce reduction by a company. They should be able to work in their chosen field, the area of their expertise, rather than being forced to either move to another location or at least work out of their immediate vicinity of where they live. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Before you leave, is there any questions for anyone on the panel? Thank you very much for coming forward. Our next panel is going to include a group of individuals. What I'm trying to do, I see that it looks like we have a number of people who wanted to come up as panels. So what I'm looking at is, I think it's going to be Jim Craven. I got Bill Campbell, and I can't tell if that's supposed to be another person or if that's the name of the company. Okay, so Jim, Bill, and then Jack Monroe, why don't you come on up, since you're on your own. That will put a panel of three. And Jim, I had you down first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jim Craven representing the American Electronics Association. We're a national trade association that represents electronics equipment manufacturers, software industry, and various versions of internet retailers and internet backbone providers. I'm going to introduce you to my witness here, Mr. Bill Campbell from the Ada Wynn Law Firm in Portland. Bill has deep experience in this part of the law and has litigated it in court, and I think particularly if you have questions about how this works in reality, Bill will be a good resource. So we we do oppose the bill in its current form. I understand there are some amendments that we just saw today. You also have in your possession Senate Bill 248 dealing with the same part of law that I do see is scheduled next week. We've been in conversations with some of the parties to this issue to see if there's some pieces we could come to agreement with, and maybe if it would be at the pleasure of the chair and the committee to give us a little bit of time between maybe now and next week when you hear that other similar bill to see if we can sort out some of the issues that are floating around. That's just a friendly suggestion. So
okay.
That both vehicles, 248 is a slightly broader relating clause and may be able to include some issues you may yet hear about today. So with that, I'm going to introduce Mr. Campbell from the Aderwin Law Firm in Portland.
Committee, I'm Bill Campbell, as Jim said, from the Aderwin Law Firm. I'm not here representing any particular party. I'm here wearing my own hat. I have had a lot of experience with this area of law. I actually was the lawyer who tried the Olston versus 4A's case, which I think is the first reported case in Oregon that dealt with the upon initial employment language that some of the stuff you're considering next week is dealing with. And I've been watching the various proposals at this session and the amendments that are before this committee for consideration, and I see some groping towards some things that actually I think are positive. I don't think we're there yet in the language I'm looking at. I'm worried about these solutions. I'd be delighted to work with committee and committee staff. I'd be delighted to work with Commissioner Gardner to come up with something that can really get to the heart of the issues that I think do matter here. With respect to the particular bill that you have under consideration today, I'd go back to a question that Senator Monroe asked of Commissioner Gardner during the commissioner's testimony, which is, won't they just fire them? And actually, I agree with the substance of the commissioner's answer that well-run businesses don't do anything on a pretext, and they won't. What's true, though, is that most terminations involve a choice of who and when to terminate. And a business that's booming along will tolerate all kinds of even close to incompetence in its employees if it has some expectation or hope that they might perform better in the future. And a business that has to lay people off will choose among its employees according to criteria that it hopes means it's keeping the best. And that often means that it's laying off people who are quite good, but maybe just, you know, maybe they're the A-minus instead of the A. But it's a choice that they're making. If you put this language, this unless laid off kind of language into the bill, what you will do is compel employers who need, from their own point of view, to enforce a non-competition covenant in order to preserve their competitive position in what may be difficult times, to at least single out, and perhaps because employers will tend to employ blanket policies on these things, maybe do it across the board, identify the employees who are being fired or terminated for their failures rather than for the economic pressures that are also contributing to the timing of the layoff. And what that means is that employers will, in all good faith, and they will be able to do this in all good faith, identify the reasons why this particular employee is to be laid off. And those reasons may be, you know, just tends to be a little bit more tardy, or it maybe is more likely to take time off than others, or those sorts of things. And does that or does that not reflect discredit on the employee in the language of this bill? I think what you would find is that employees who are now terminated in economically difficult times, but for choices that the employer is making, will get identified as being subpar performers. The defect of that is not so much about whether the non-competition agreement will bite them or not, although it may, and I sympathize with the testimonies from the previous panel on this point, any subsequent employer, upon interviewing the employee coming in, is going to ask, why did you leave your last job? And if it is handled the way it's handled now, most employers will simply say, look, it was an economic downturn and leave it at that. But if there is a consequence of a right that they have found valuable and that was important to them being lost, if they allow that ambiguity to stay, then they will be compelled to identify the reason. And the honest employee, and most employees are honest, will say, you know, I tended to be a little bit tardy, and so that was the reason I was chosen, or whatever it is. Well, that's not something that this committee or this legislature should want the employee to have to deal with. Nor is it a position that you really want to be putting employers of the state in to force them to identify not pretextual, legitimate. These are the legitimate reasons why these employees, as opposed to others at the time of the downturn, were selected. But reasons that at the end of the day shouldn't affect whether that employee can find the next job. These are things that I genuinely worry about in this language. I think that there is a serious issue around non-competes in this state that I'd be delighted again to work with committee or committee staff or with the commissioner to sort out. I think there are better potential solutions here, and I see some of the language groping towards some of the things that I think are pieces of the solution. I'd like to make one comment about the electronics industry, with which I have worked extensively. And I note that the examples that Commissioner Gardner gave, although he said that the electronics industry was his primary example, none of those examples came from the electronics industry. In fact, in my experience, non-competition covenants among the highly paid employees of the electronics industry are not widely used in this state. And I've always wondered why that was, because I think they are more widely used in Washington state. I'm not saying they're unused. There are examples of them being used. I think the reason they are not widely used in this state is that our largest employer for the electronics industry here is Intel, and one of our largest is Hewlett-Packard. Both of those companies are based in California, and their employment practices are set in California. And neither of them use non-competition covenants, which means if you want to compete with them for talent, you don't use non-competition covenants either. And mostly you can protect yourself not using non-competition covenants through other methods. There are a few areas of legitimate interest to employers that right now can only be protected through non-competition covenants. There may be other ways to address that. I'd be delighted to work again with Commissioner Gardner and with the committee to think of those as we go forward. I just don't think that the current language I'm looking at gets at the right issues and may create unintended consequences that would really be sad for employees and employers both in the state. Thank you.
Thank you. Jack?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jack Monroe, speaking today on behalf of the Independent Insurance Agents and Brokers of Oregon. I actually was more prepared to sort of play an amen role today, and I know Lana Butterfield has both a couple of agents here and an attorney who deals with those agents to deal with what may be the details of the application of this issue relative to insurance agents and insurance agencies. But to summarize, the value of an insurance agency is very directly related to the value of the perceived value of the customer's book. And the book is essentially that list of customers, the expiration dates of policies that are insured through that agency, and other information relative to that coverage. And agencies in a great many cases, of course, protect the value of that book using non-compete agreements. And you might assert, as was unfortunately I was out at the beginning of the presentation, but you might assert, for example, that this information qualifies as a trade secret and is therefore protected through existing Oregon law. But the fact of the matter is that, at least as it relates to agencies, the law really isn't clear as to how broad it might be.
Jack, I need to stop. We have to change tapes. I'm sorry.
trade secrets. The fact of the matter is that there are some issues that have come up in other jurisdictions that simply aren't clear here in the state of Oregon, such as the status of memorized information that a party might take away from the relationship. But, you know, I think on a broader context, the bill, at least from my perspective, doesn't make a lot of sense in that it particular series of, or this particular statutory provision that is amended here, or the suggested amendment, it suggests that, you know, these agreements are certainly valid and enforceable if entered into under certain circumstances, and this bill essentially takes those agreements and at some particular point in time, given a subsequent circumstance, renders them unenforceable. And I think that's a problem, certainly a logical problem. Much as has already been suggested, I think if there's a problem with non-competition agreements, we ought to enunciate that problem and take it head on. And if, for example, there is a problem with the variant that we might generally call a territorial restriction of some sort, then we ought to deal with that. We ought to enunciate the problem and deal with it. And, you know, courts have been doing that for some time in refusing to enforce agreements that are overly broad or that essentially make it impossible for a person to utilize their skills and find employment within, in the case of those that are unenforceable, a very broad geographic area. But if there's a problem, let's take it on and discuss it.
Ms. Monroe, I need to kind of wrap up. I've got four panels.
You bet. I think that's, I think maybe I've said all that I need to say, and you know, it would be our suggestion that that you not act on the measure, but if you do, there is an amendment, I think, that's before you, the -2 amendment, that carves out a type of agreement that deals with essentially anti-pirating, and essentially would say that that an agreement that restricts somebody from calling on clients and attempting to lure clients away within a certain period of time is one that wouldn't be subject to the provisions of this measure. So thank you.
All right, fine. Thank you. Before we take questions, I do want to make it does sound like, Jack, you know of the -2, because I was just looking at that. It seems like that may capture some of the issues you were concerned with.
It certainly would for us.
All right. Any questions for anyone on the panel? Mr. Campbell, I've got three questions for you. I guess one of them is going back to what we've heard from the commissioner as to Texas and California outright prohibits these type of non-compete. And it seems like both of those states are flourishing and activities is abound. Are you familiar with, I know that you made some mention of the high-tech being based, such as Intel and HP in California, I believe.
Yes.
And so they're not using them up here. It just seemed, I guess from the chair's perspective, I'm trying to get a perspective of why those states are able to flourish and their commerce continue, but they don't allow these type of provisions in contracts.
Senator Przanski, from my personal point of view, I'd go, I'd make a few other observations along the same line. You and I believe are both attorneys, and Senator Avakian is an attorney. Our profession, according to the rules of our professional conduct, absolutely bars non-competition covenants. Our profession seems to have the theory that the client should pick who they use, and we seem to be able to make a living. Well, some of us better than others, I suppose. But I don't think it's necessary for commerce in that sense across the board. I notice the medical profession, the accounting profession don't share that, and some of our most egregious examples seem to come from the medical profession in this area. In the electronics world, I haven't noticed any dearth of success among the electronics companies in California, so I'd have to agree with you there. And as I say, most of our clients do not use non-competition covenants in the electronics industry. The place where I have sympathy with non-competition covenants really in any industry is in areas where the employer has put substantial investment behind the public-facing character and the customer-facing character and the customer-facing knowledge of the particular employee. And this is actually what Jack Monroe is referring to in the insurance industry. Basically, anytime you pour a lot of energy into teaching some individual exactly what your particular customer, prospective customer, is looking for, that's really valuable information. And if they can pick up and take it across the street, even if you've laid them off, that's a lot of investment you've put behind that you're going to think twice about doing. From a public policy point of view, I don't think this committee should care whether the employers have put a lot of investment behind it or not. That's a risk they've taken. But I think this committee should care whether it makes it less likely that they will put an investment behind the next guy, because I think we want that kind of training to happen. My view is that the most critical area that cannot now be protected through trade secrets is exactly what the customers want. And the reason that can't be protected through trade secrets is a technical legal issue, and it is that the customers desire and want and knowledge and requirements are not trade secrets of the employer. They are trade secrets, if they are, they are trade secrets of the customer, and the employee is entitled to take them across the street without breaching any duty owed to the employer, nonetheless the employer may have invested a lot behind it.
Okay.
So that's the area that I'd look for a way to work on in this zone. The stories I hear about people who aren't customer-facing and have nothing to do with anything that could be reviewed as competition from the point of view of a customer being shut out of a field that they understand always drive me crazy. I don't understand why anybody would put a non-competition covenant in place in those areas.
All right, Ms. Campbell, thank you. I'm going to bow on those other two questions I had, and unless there's any other questions, I'm going to bring the next panel up. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Lana Butterfield, looks like Ron Manza, and Randy Sutton.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Lana Butterfield. Our panel is going to present in the way that it seems most appropriate. We've got some written documentation, and we won't read it all. With me is an attorney, Randy Sutton, and Ron Manza, who is an insurance agency owner. Ron?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Ron Manza of Stewart and Tuno Insurance Agency in East Multnomah County in Portland. Today I'm wearing two hats. I'm also the Oregon Government Relations Chair for the Professional Insurance Agents of Oregon and Idaho. As the current bill states, we are opposed to that because our agency's value is in the business that we've built up. Stewart & Tuno has been in business 50 years this year. We employ 19 people. And the value of our agency is in our client lists and the clients that we've built up over that time. We hire local folks. We spend a lot of money to train them. An agent that comes into the office usually takes a very large investment in multiple thousands in a couple years. We need the protection of our non-compete agreements. Those agreements allow us to continue in business and protect ourselves on the hires that maybe weren't the best hire to begin with, or for somebody that wants to move on for whatever reason. Our non-competes allow them to work across the street if they wish in the same profession. They just cannot solicit our client base, the client base that we develop and we pay them to develop. And that's basically the crux of our overall statements, and you've got all that in written testimony, and that's about as short as I could keep it. Thank you.
That's very good. Thank you very much. And I'm assuming that you're referring to the Dash 2s as to something you would be
yes,
favoring.
The non-piracy amendment.
Okay, thank you very much.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Randy Sutton. I'm a partner with Soffel Griggs Law Firm here in Salem, and I litigate both for employers and employees in this area, and I've done a number of cases in this regard. And I'll tell you that they're not easy to either prosecute or defend. I've been on both sides of it, and it's always a battle. And that's because Oregon law is very restrictive already in this area. It requires goods consideration up front and initial employment. And I would contrast some of the testimony earlier today with regard to the scope of the agreement. They're not enforceable if they're not limited, and they've got to be limited both in geography and they've got to be limited in duration. If you have a non-compete involving a local dentist, a restriction for the entire state of Oregon is not going to fly with any judge that I've ever been up against. It's got to be tailored to the particular situation that we're dealing with. And so there are a lot of built-in protections, and courts take a dim view for overreaching agreements. So with that premise, as far as what I've always dealt with, I think we need to balance the interest between the employer and the employee. And as has been said before, the employee needs to earn a livelihood. The employer needs to protect his investment. The Professional Insurance Agency, or agents of Oregon that I'm here representing, they have built their business based on customer relationships. It's the accounts that they want to get renewals on time and time again. Now, keep in mind with non-competition agreements, there's more than one kind of non-competition agreement. There's a non-competition agreement that says in this geographical area, and in the case of insurance agents, it might be a 10, 15, 20-mile radius. It's not going to be the state of Oregon typically. In this geographical area, you can't compete with us. You need to go out of town. It's a commute, but they're still able to earn a living. The other type of non-competition agreement that we see very often is the non-piracy type agreement, and that's an agreement that says you can go work across the street if you want to. You can work for an established agency, or you can start your own. Just don't take my customers with you. I hired you with the understanding that you wouldn't do that. You worked for me, and I paid you to establish relationships and to foster relationships. And the thing that the trade secret laws does not protect, that a non-competition agreement does protect, is the customer relationship. The fact that you're servicing a particular customer, those customer's needs, may or may not be trade secret. It's always going to be subject to argument. But that information, even if it wasn't trade secret, even if the competitor could get it, will not do a lot of good. It's the relationship. And when you think about the businesses that you do business with, think about the people that you deal with. And it's not so much the information about you that matters, but the people that are servicing you and their relationship with you. And so a non-competition agreement that says you're not going to pirate my customers basically gives a time for the relationship to cool and for the new employee to come in and help service those accounts. The Dash 2 amendment is an effort to, although we would like to see this bill not go forward, if it does go forward, we'd ask that the Dash 2 amendment be considered. And essentially it deals with non-piracy. It says, don't solicit, don't serve our customers. And so we'd like to see that be the form of agreement. Again, the courts are not going to enforce this unless it's fair. And so I think the legal protections in Oregon. And in response to the inquiry about California, my understanding, and I don't practice California law, but my understanding is that non-solicitation agreements are enforceable in California. So even the non-piracy is very similar. And I will say, in dealing with agreements from outside jurisdictions, the requirements to have a valid agreement in the first place are much stricter here in Oregon than in other states. In other states, as a condition of continued employment, you say, sign this or I'll fire you. That's enforceable in most of the states. Oregon is very restrictive in that regard, and we don't allow that here. So there's a lot of built-in protections already. I think our amendment is another protection, and we've got to balance the needs of the business and the employee. Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you very much. Any questions? Thank you all for coming forward. The last panel I have on 616 is Rich Kingsley. And I'm sorry, there's someone that signed in up underneath Rich's name, and I cannot read that. It looks like maybe another Kingsley. Okay. And then Nick Fish. And Rich, you can go first, and Nick, you'll follow.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rich Kingsley. I'm the owner of Kingsley Insurance Agency in Staten, Oregon, and I want to agree with the last two speakers and say that I'm fully in favor of the way they presented it.
All right. So the Dash 2s would meet your needs.
Yes.
That would be great. Thank you very much for coming forward. Nick.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify. And it's especially an honor to appear before my state senator, Senator Gordley.
I'm here as...
You need to put your name on the record.
Excuse me. My name is Nick Fish. I am here as a private citizen, although I was here today for a meeting with the Oregon Cultural Trust Board, and I hope that you're all supporting the CHAMP initiative.
politics. I don't think that bill's before us now, though.
That's quite all right.
I'll tell Chris Darcy I got that in. I am with the firm of Meyer & Wise, and the firm represents small businesses as well as individuals. Most of my practice is representing individuals in employment disputes. Mr. Chair, I believe that Commissioner Gardner's legislation is well-intentioned, and I support it, but frankly, it doesn't go far enough. In my view, non-competition agreements should be void and unenforceable across the board in Oregon. They are, in my judgment and in the judgment of most of the other states that have tackled this issue, illegal restraints on trade, and they are morally wrong. They are illegal in California, which, last I checked, was the home to both Hollywood and Silicon Valley. They are unfair. Under Oregon law today, if I am fired because I have opposed an illegal practice in my workplace, my employer can still enforce a non-competition covenant. And that is simply wrong. I believe in Michigan that has been corrected through the common law. But that would still be in Oregon. If you are fired for an illegal reason, the employer can still enforce 653-295, the non-competition agreement. In addition, these covenants are largely unnecessary. You've heard previous panels talk about the Uniform Trade Secrets Act, which has been codified in Oregon under ORS 646.461. That's a lethal tool. That says that if you take customer lists and appropriate them and use them, if you're an insurance agent who takes your customers across the street, if you're an insurance broker, if you are anybody who takes your Rolodex or any of that proprietary information across the street when you set up shop, you can be sued, and it's a big stick. There's an attorney fee provision. There's a damage clause. No one wants to be a defendant in an action brought under the Uniform Trade Secret Act. In addition, there are existing contractual remedies short of a non-competition covenant, and the most commonly known one is a confidentiality clause, which defines the scope of proprietary information at the workplace that remains confidential after the expiration of the employment relationship. And, of course, there are a number of common law duties which are already well recognized, including the duty of loyalty with respect to your employer's property. I also believe that existing law is damaging to the economy in the sense that it limits innovation. What is more American than starting your way up the ladder and leaving one employer to start a job across the street that may or may not compete? In my view, the evidence is overwhelming that the benefits to a few outweigh the damage to the many. And finally, it is grossly abused in this state. And we have stories that you have read about in the paper, and I can tell you from my own practice. How about the gentleman who worked for a parking garage in downtown Portland, making the minimum wage, whose contract had a restrictive covenant that prevented him, upon being fired, from going to work for another garage, a minimum wage worker? Or as the AFTER representative testified to, the entry-level television reporter, who works the 5 to 6 o'clock shift, who's making $44,000 a year, who can be fired under their contract because some gray starts showing up in the hair or because the ratings aren't good, and who can be prevented throughout the term of the contract from working for anyone without their permission, and at the expiration of the contract, from working for a competitor for between 6 months and a year. There are horror stories that abound in this area, and as one of the prior witnesses said, these clauses are applied routinely across industries and across titles, and they are inappropriate for the great majority of individuals to whom they are applied. I would urge this committee to join with California and other jurisdictions to simply make these void and unenforceable as a matter of law. Short of that, I believe that that the Commissioner Gardner's proposal represents a common sense incremental change which deserves your support. In the context of a layoff, when an employer has made the judgment that you as an employee no longer have value for whatever reason, it is simply wrong to say that that person is limited in their choices for future work and can no longer work in their industry. And for many people, that essentially means you cannot work in the state of Oregon in your chosen field. And it is no solace to be told that, well, you just can wait 2 years until the expiration of the non-compete and get back into your job. Think of the fields that each of you have come from and if you have worked in. If you're out of the game for 6 months, a year, 2 years, imagine how difficult it is to get back into your employment. Now, there is one class of people, one group of people who are going to be vociferously opposed to my proposal, and that is the lawyers that make a living off of drafting and enforcing these provisions. And you've heard prior testimony that when these cases go to court, they are hotly contested, and I can attest to that. But what that misses is the human face, because I would imagine about 95% of the people who have these clauses and who are prevented from working simply don't have the resources, the access to a lawyer, the time, or the heart to fight them. And what they do is that they choose to go into some other field rather than to contest them. The fights, and most of the case law will back me up on this, are between highly compensated people and corporations where there's a lot at stake. Finally, if I may, there was some commentary about certain classes of individuals, particularly highly compensated people in certain industries. And I'd just like to tip my hat to Nike, because I've had some experience with cases involving Nike. And for their senior, highly paid individuals, they have a policy which says for the right to enforce a non-compete, they will provide that individual with salary continuation for the period of the non-competition period. And I think that that makes a lot of sense. There's something inherently inequitable about enforcing it and not providing any compensation. And the law currently provides for that, as you know, under the bonus restriction agreement. So if an employer wants to pay you to not work in the field for a period of time, that seems to me something an employer and employee should be able to negotiate. Otherwise, these things are unnecessary, unfair, in my judgment, morally wrong. I urge you to make them void and unenforceable across the board. But short of that, I think that Commissioner Gardner's proposal makes a lot of sense. And I thank you for the chance to testify.
Thank you very much. Questions for either?
Thank you very much. Just to say hello, Mr. Fish.
Hello, Senator.
Great to see you. Thank you very much for the excellent testimony. And on the other subject that you squeezed in, perhaps I'll see you up in Portland at a performance of Vince's.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. All right, thank you very much. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 616. We're going to go ahead and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 688. And, gentlemen, I'm going to go ahead and have you come up. Anna, you're going to give us the overview. So this is Mr. Williamson, Mr. Entler, and Mr. Guire.
Guither.
And let me tell you, gentlemen, I'm going to ask you to keep your testimony succinct. I think there's a lot of, let's say, understanding this to the issues and moving this forward. And the quicker we can get through yours, we can stay on time with the other hearing that we have.
Great. We have talked to, I think, everybody on the panel, except we couldn't get in to see Senator Gordley, although we tried.
No problem.
And we have passed out written testimony.
Yeah. Charlie.
I'm sorry, Charles Williamson.
Yeah, and before you get started, I got to let Anna kind of give us the overview, and then we'll come right to it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 688 clarifies that taxi cab drivers that lease by the shift or who are under contract to provide services to a third party are exempt from workers' compensation insurance. There's a -1 amendment. That -1 amendment adds to the language of lease by the shift or for a longer period to cover all leasing arrangements. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very briefly, Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, this bill simply...
Can you say your name?
Charles Williamson. Phil Altman runs the Portland, represent Radio Cab and Broadway Cab here. With me today is Stephen Entler, General Manager of Radio Cab, and David Weither, a driver for Radio Cab. This bill, to our knowledge, has no opposition. The drivers for it, management's for it. SAFE does not oppose it. It simply... changes the law so that current practices can continue to have drivers rent a cab and be in their own business and be independent contractors or at least non-exempt employees for the purpose of workers' comp. And it
says that if they don't, if they happen to be carrying out a part of a contract with TriMet to, or a school district or whatever to carry someone under that contract, that that doesn't make them an employee. At Radio Cab, it's common for people to just come in and rent a cab for one shift. At Broadway Cab, we just started out just representing Radio Cab. At Broadway Cab, they rent for a longer period of time. And out in Eugene, I think they rent for a longer period of time with Oregon Taxi and Sassy's Cab in Oregon City. They go by month or by 6 months or so. So the Dash 1 amendments are really essential to cover all the cab companies. I am mindful, Senator Prezantsky, of the thing you mentioned about does this make them more of an employee if it's longer. I think we can deal with that in the contracts with the drivers rather than in this legislation, and we will research that and address that, but I don't think we need to do it in the bill.
Okay.
I did talk with Charlie Cheeks about that it's common that people will rent for a shift. So you might rent for a month for a certain shift, for a year for a certain shift. And Mr. Cheeks believes that these amendments, even though they say for a period, that that covers a successive bunch of periods. And so we're satisfied with it, and we urge the committee to adopt the amendments and pass the bill out. And if Mr. Entler and Mr. Gweiss will, and I will be glad to answer your questions, but that's in a nutshell.
All right. Let me ask if there's anyone that has any questions. Senator Gordley, I know that it sounds like you were not able to meet with them previously. I think, from my understanding, they've met with everyone else. Do you feel comfortable going forward?
I do. I have no issues.
All right. Senator Byron.
Yeah, question, Mr. Chair. I just want to get for the purposes of workers' comp, as we're talking about, but have you or have any of these cab drivers been gone through either employment department or tax purposes been deemed as employees or independent contractors?
I think we're okay there so far anyway, and we may be back another day to talk about that in another session. This is the immediate fire we need to put out. We believe that with the contracts and with the working agreements that we can handle the other issues that may arise.
Follow it, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
And this is not a question for you. I think maybe for Honor or for someone else. But it seems like I recall that we passed a statute a few sessions back saying that if one agency finds or determines a person to be considered an employee, all agencies have to follow that same ruling, and vice versa. If one agency considers an independent contractor, all the agencies are supposed to treat the same individual in the same manner because they're all using the same rules and determinations. So my question, I guess, for someone would be, isn't that a statute? And if it is, then for the agencies, why are they not following that statute?
Okay. That's on the record. Ms. Williamson, unless you've got something. We do have Chris Davey that's going to be coming up for the Safe Corporation. He's our last witness. I don't know if he can assist us as to, you know, their perspective. Of course, that's not, quote-unquote, a state agency.
Yeah.
But,
well, I can just briefly say it was SAFE that raised the – it was, and it wasn't even SAFE that raised it. The driver goes into the doctor, and the doctor says, oh, you're at work, and they put in for workers' comp. And what happened, I think it was in Forest Grove, and I believe in Eugene, that a driver took the case to an administrative law judge who said, no, I think you are covered. You have to be covered. You're not a non-subject worker. And they were just looking at the non-subject worker statute primarily, although they may have analyzed the contractor statute as well. But it's only that far that it's gone. Nobody's it's not that SAFE is saying you are and others are saying you're not. SAFE is saying we're fine with the bill as long as we just don't want to provide coverage if we're not getting paid premiums, which is a reasonable position for them to take. So that's just as far as
Williamson, I need you to stop for a second. We're changing tapes.
Not to a point where even SAFE is treating all the drivers as employees as yet. Nobody's paying a premium for them, so it hasn't gotten out of into the other agencies.
Any other questions?
No, I just like to clarify.
Okay. All right. Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Davey, why don't you come on up, and then
Jerry Manahan.
Mr. Manahan,
could you please also come on up and maybe give us some answer a question once Mr. Davey has a chance to speak?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'm Chris Davey from Safe Corporation. And speaking here, I signed up as neutral on this bill. We're not taking a position on this bill, but I think it's important to put this in context. What this bill is about is whether the taxi companies should pay workers' compensation premiums for a segment of their workforce. And there has been a lot of litigation over the years about whether taxi drivers in certain situations are workers that are subject to the law, and consequently whether there is premium that is owed by the taxi companies for that potential exposure if there is a claim, because the requirement to pay premium is obviously triggered by the potential for claims being filed from members of the workforce. Now, in most cases, of course, that we see every day, it's very easy to tell whether somebody is a subject to the workers' compensation law or not in a conventional working relationship. The law says that if a person provides services and receives remuneration, then they are a worker and they're subject to the workers' compensation law unless they fall under one of the exemptions in the statute, which is in 656.027. And that's all laid out in the bill in front of you, and you can see there are something like 27 different subsections for people who may not be subject to the law. What this bill does is to make some minor changes to the section that, or the subsection that talks about owner-operators of taxi cabs. And unfortunately, this has become very complex. It's complex in the first place because of the relationship between this statute and the definition of a taxi cab. And over the years, the relationships between the cab companies and their drivers have evolved in a way that adds to that complexity and has led to some disputes about who is a worker and who owes premium. What I tried to do to make some sense out of this was to put together the table that's on the second page of my testimony. And here you see the seven criteria that are plucked from two different statutes that have to be met for somebody to be not subject to the workers' compensation law, where they would not be able to file a claim and there would be no premium that is payable. The middle column really lays out the areas that are in dispute, either because there have been findings by the court where an injured worker has filed a claim and been found to be a worker, even though that person was not having premium reported, or else through audit disputes when we have gone out and audited an employer and found that there were people who we thought were subject workers, but the employer had not reported them, and then those cases have been litigated too. And I won't go through that in detail, but you can see the seven points that have to be met and the areas where there has been some dispute, and then how Senate Bill 688 would change that. What our interest is in this issue is having a nice, clear standard. And because of the way that these relationships have changed, the standard is not clear anymore, and obviously that's what leads to litigation. So if this bill were to be passed in its present form, it would clear up some of the things that have been disputed, and it would limit the amount of litigation. It would do that by moving some people who today are considered to be subject workers under the workers' comp law out of the eligibility to file a claim if they were injured. So we take no position on the bill. That's a policy choice for the legislature to make. We just want the system to be one that is clear and easy for everybody to administer. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right, thank you. I want to open up the panel for questions. And Senator Byard, if you want to re-ask that question, let's see if we can get an answer now.
Yeah, and I don't know that SAFE would be the proper people. Chris may know the statute, but perhaps our representative from the Employment Department here could answer the question. You heard the question, but I think there is a statute that says that workers' comp, for purposes of determining if a person is an employee or an independent contractor, revenue, workers' comp, and Employment Department are all supposed to use the same test, and the test is supposed to be applied the same, and each agency is supposed to come up with the same answer or use the one that's already been decided upon. Is that a statute, or are you aware of the statute if it is?
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Jerry Manahan. I'm the Deputy Administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division, which is part of the Department of Consumer Business Services. Senator Byer, last session, Senate Bill 323 was passed, which basically links the agencies to apply to the independent contractor statute under ORS 670-600 so that all the agencies apply that statute the same. Workers' comp is a little bit different in that before we apply that test, we determine whether or not a person's a worker. And to determine that, you find out whether or not that person is free from direction and control of another person. So we, as we look to apply the employment law, we first say, is that person a worker? So we would look to see if they're free from direction and control. And if they're not free from direction and control, we consider them to be a subject worker under the workers' comp law. And at that point, under this bill that's being considered, we would then look within the workers' comp statute to say whether or not they've been excluded from the benefits under workers' compensation. And under, like I say, as previous testimony had said, that there are like 27 different areas of law where certain individuals have been carved out of the system, and this would add one more to that for those individuals that currently would be considered workers based upon that employment relationship between them and their employer.
So, if I may, Mr. Chair, do either of you know then, has for purposes of employment or revenue, have these same workers been considered employees or independent contractors?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I am not aware of any cases specifically, but we could check with the other agencies. My suspicion would be that because of the right of direction control, which is also applied in the other agencies, that they would come up with the same determination as the workers' comp law.
Any other questions?
Employees are employees.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen. All right. Chair's intent, if we're comfortable as a committee to move this bill, I'm ready to go ahead and move it with the dash ones. Senator Beyer, I'm not sure if you're satisfied at this point or not.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'll vote for the bill. I'll just focus because we're in a little work session and make my comments in the record.
Okay. There. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 688. Open a work session on Senate Bill 688. And we'll take a motion for the dash ones.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendments into 688.
Senator Barr moves the dash one amendments into Senate Bill 688. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 688 as amended to the floor with a new pass recommendation.
Senator Byers moves Senate Bill 688 as amended by the dash ones to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion, Senator Byers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's just what we do and what we've done in my 10 years down here now is we keep adding to a list of people who can't meet a test. And the test, and we worked on it last session with Senate Bill 6323, and at that time, Senator Walker was very involved in that. Her and I have been involved in this for many sessions down here, and I think what we're still seeing is that we have agencies who are unequally applying the same test, or we have a test and a process that isn't right, because we have workers or we have, you know, groups of people. Every session I've been here, I've come forward and said, I'm not an employee. You need to exempt me under with my own little carve-out. Yet we've got thousands or hundreds of thousands of people out there who also would like to be say they're not employees, but they don't have a lobbyist, but they don't have political clout to come down here and get a bill passed to get them their little carve-out, because this test is broken, and this test is still obviously broken if we have to continue after what we did last session to pass bills to create a little carve-out for another class of worker. And I'll vote for the bill. I voted for almost all of them that have come forward, but every time I say this, it's not the proper way to do it, and if the process is wrong and flawed, we should fix the process. And we, as I said, we tried last session, but we must have failed.
All right. Any other comments? All right. Any objections to the motion that's before us? Not seeing any. It passes, and it will go to the floor. And any volunteers on carrier? Not. Senator Avakian will take this one.
All right, so we close the work session on Senate Bill 688. We're now going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 1035.
Still have any questions?
Representative Gordley, did you want to speak from here, or did you want to go to the podium?
Senator Gordley will speak from here.
Okay. Oh, no.
I did have that experience. In fact, I shared it with you.
Yeah. I apologize.
Not
Senator.
A problem.
All right, so I want to make my apologies to those who are going to be coming forward. I have a meeting that starts in about 10 minutes, so I'm going to have to be leaving, but we will continue to take all the public testimony. It's the chair's intent at this point to take all the public testimony. Senator Gordley and I have briefly spoken, and we'll speak afterwards as to what our next steps will be after we get the testimony in. So, Anna, why don't you go ahead and give us the overview for 1035?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 1035 makes harassment, intimidation, or bullying an unlawful employment practice, and it allows for civil legal action, but it specifically exempts jurisdiction from the Bureau of Labor and Industries. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. And so I'll go ahead. Let's see. I guess we've opened it up. Senator Gordley, why don't you go ahead and give us your opening presentation.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And I would just ask that you call up Cal Robertson, Dr. Namy, and Carol Patton as I begin my remarks. They form the first panel.
That would be wonderful. If you would come forward, please. I think it's Gary Namy, was it Cal Roberts, and Carol Patton?
It's Cal Robertson.
Cal Robertson. Oh,
yes.
I'm sorry.
And
thank you all very much for
the
coming.
Second panel, at the request of Cal Robertson, will include Brett Cody and Dr. Deborah Harris.
Okay, great.
And Mr. Chair and colleagues, I want to first of all thank Cal Robertson and Odessa Hendrick, who's unable to be here today, for bringing this issue forward. The issue is workplace bullying, and Cal Robertson and Odessa Hendricks, both constituents, have experienced bullying in the workplace. It is their experiences that inform why this legislation is needed. Senate Bill 1035 makes harassment, intimidation, or bullying an unlawful employment practice. Violations of Senate Bill 1035 would allow for a civil action, but not enforcement by the Bureau of Labor and Industries. I also want to make the point for the record today that there is no fiscal impact to Senate Bill 1035. There's no state regulatory function or department involved. This legislation prohibits only extreme abusive misconduct. Managers' rights are preserved. I also want to indicate for the record that I have received letters of support for this legislation from around the state, including Portland, Molalla, Coos Bay, Corvallis, and I want to enter into the record a email received from Roger Brandt, who was unable to be here today. He's from Cave Junction, Oregon. And I'll share this with staff to be handed out, along with my own comments for the record. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And so since we have a panel here, I'm going to let you start in whatever order you'd like to go. And if you just give us your name.
My name's Gary Namy, and I'm the director of the Workplace Bullying Institute. Yes, there is such a thing. And I've come down from Bellingham, Washington today to address you, and instead of the slideshow, fortunately, I made a copy of the slides. So I'm only going to do a subset of those because of time. I'm here to basically introduce the phenomenon and sort of give you the statistical background, and no story is complete without the pairing of the anecdotal with the statistical, so I want you to know that. So I'm going to yield to these folks here very, very soon because their stories are so compelling. And I urge you to listen to the stories and believe them. The folks that experience this are rarely believed. It is a classic phenomenon. I'm also the co-author of the book, The Bully at Work, which was our second book. And, yes, I did live through it personally because it happened to my wife, Dr. Ruth, and that's why we started in 1997. The movement's 10 years old this year, middle of this year. I didn't go looking for this kind of misery, trust me. First and foremost, workplace bullying is a British term. Imported is created by a BBC radio reporter who was so appalled by the abuse of bank tellers that she started the British movement. wrote the first book, but had died of cancer within 4 years. So it's important, I want to direct you to the front page, to the synonyms. There is only one existing North American law, and it is in the province of Quebec, and it dubs it psychological harassment. I sit on the NIOSH, National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health Task Force on Workplace Bullying, and it is agreed that it is a form of psychological violence in the workplace. Bullying is sublethal, non-physical mistreatment of folks. It is not to be mistaken for something trivial or flippant or not affecting them. In fact, it causes a great deal of health harm, as I'll show you. It could be comprised of either verbal abuse, threats, intimidation, humiliating conduct, verbal or nonverbal. And most importantly, it's sabotage. It actually prevents work from getting done, contrary to the mythology that you have to be a bully boss or a highly aggressive jerk to get the best out of work staff. And indeed, it undermines work. And it is really the exercise of some one individual's personal agenda instead of getting the work done. How prevalent is it? Second page. Well, for years and years, I've been citing the only national standard from a study of Michigan residents, because it's a scientific sample we can extrapolate, and one in six workers in a given year are exposed to it and experience bullying as I defined it. But a brand new study by an employment group called the Employment Law Alliance just came out in March. It's had quite a bit of press coverage, and I've been asked to comment a great deal about it. And they said that 45% of workers had been subjected to an abusive boss, but that's in their working lifetime. And when they do European surveys and they ask, have you ever been bullied in your work life, it hovers around 50%. You live long enough, you're going to run into enough of these folks. It's just a matter of probability. And there is a Quebec provincial survey back in 2006. So we're familiar with all the international research. It's safe to say it hovers between 10 and 30%. So that's a significant proportion of the population of a workforce. That's an epidemic proportion. And in fact, the International Labor Organization, ILO, has deemed it an epidemic, a silent epidemic. It is three times more prevalent than illegal harassment. A quick legal, I'm not a lawyer. I do expert witness work, but I'm certainly not a lawyer. But it is unmistakable that the general population does not understand that a hostile work environment is not illegal for everyone. You have to be a member of a protected status group, and your aggressor, your harasser, your bully cannot also be a member of a protected group. In other words, same-sex, same-race harassment rarely meets the criterion for harassment illegalities. And therefore, that's key. Employers rely upon the law to drive the policies. If it is not, therefore, illegal, it's problematic for the employer and most likely for the bully, well, more likely for the bully target. We don't call them victims. The people we're going to talk to are targets. Once they're out of the crosshairs, they're safe. But it can take up to 22 months, according to our research, to get out from under that. 50% of all bullying is woman on woman, for instance. So The Devil Wears Prada was a movie that prompted a great deal of interest in bullying, again, as it constantly does. The bully types are cute, but we don't need to talk about them. If you go to the, there are, and they're wonderful, but that's for a longer talk. Are all bosses bullies? No. Are most bullies bosses? Yes. They do outrank. 7 out of 10 do outrank the targeted person. This lends credibility and leverage to make good on the stripping away of someone's economic livelihood, because I can threaten you as a boss. As a coworker, then you can see 17% of U.S. bullying is peer-to-peer. They can do many other things to you too, but they're not going to take away your job. The slide that shows reasons adults become targets, I simply want to say that in general, the people who are targeted for bullying are not the weak loner equivalent of the child in the corner of the playground with a Coke bottle, glasses, and not a group to back them up. They are usually technically more proficient than the person who bullies them, and they pose a threat, a social threat. That's usually what it is. You'll find they're very experienced people. They'll tell you their story. And pity the poor whistleblower, because all whistleblowers are bullied. Not everyone who's bullied is a whistleblower. Why do we care? Because of the health impact on the individual and on organizations. So impact is important. No time to go over the extensive research on the fact that just the perception of an unfair workplace leads to a 30% increased risk of cardiac failure. Unfairness. We've got So there's a whole book on summarizing the epidemiological research, the workplace, and cardiovascular disease. The science is emerging now. I have a lot of it at our website, our teaching website, bullyinginstitute.org. And it's amazing that the unremitting exposure to stress actually causes irreversible brain damage in terms of shrinking the hippocampus. It triggers trauma pathways. I love that science. I just wanted the science is great to show how real it is, and much of it is generated in Europe. Much of it is generated. The founder of the international movement was the first to link bullying with PTSD, and you can see that 30% of women who are bullied suffer PTSD. Why in the world? How is it justified that you would suffer a war wound, post-traumatic stress, from just going to work? And it is that extreme. The nation is now being traumatized with the Virginia Tech experience. It's always a teaching moment when we go through trauma. People wouldn't want to believe that this happens to them, but these testifiers will tell you these stories are all very real. We've heard them by the thousands, which led to my own bypass surgery, I might add. All the international founders are dead or dying. It is incredibly taxing to the people who do this kind of work, too. Employers should care because it is costly. The tangible employer costs and the litmus test, the primary indicator that the destructive interpersonal misconduct is actually happening and that an abusive work environment is operating, is turnover. They should care from a bottom line perspective. We actually do consulting with businesses, primarily Canadian, who bring us in to write policies and to attack this in a systemic way. But we deal a lot with whack-a-mole and try and rehabilitate bullies, too. They are unrehabilitatable. I will just tell you that. But anyway, it's costly in terms of tangible and intangible costs to employers. The U.S. is the final industrialized nation that doesn't have laws to address this. It's not just the gap in civil rights law. It's just that it's totally another realm. The legal treatise on workplace bullying was written by Professor David Yamada in the year 2000, Georgetown Law Journal, and he basically looked at the closest law to it now, the tort of intentional infliction of emotional distress, and said it's not. In the court, the courts are very loath to grant that the conduct that they hear about in cases like these that you're going to hear constitutes outrageous enough conduct. To you and me, and non-legal professionals on the street, it sounds like outrageous conduct, but the courts are very unfriendly. We are the last country to do anything about it. Quebec, I do a lot of work in Canada, and they're changing occupational health and safety regulations. We just came back from Ireland. They have it. The draft language that we provided to the Oregon Senate was actually the basis for South African National Code. Everybody's got it in the industrialized world but us. I think that's it. That's all I want to say. I did get to hear. I always tell a Holocaust story in the end of my speeches, but I've been now impressed. I got to meet the guy that was the story behind Paul Russo-Vagina, whatever, the fellow behind Hotel Rwanda. And it's a remarkable story in the sense that he said, I was the lone person to stand up and say no to abuse, and I don't know why so many others said yes. So I put the quote in there. And right now what we typically do is we say, bullying is a way of organizational life. It's just what we need to succeed. You'll hear every business group testify in the 12 states. We've given you the bill history, 27 versions in 12 different states so far. It's mounting. There's constant press attention to it. Employer attorneys are starting to warn in legal newsletters to employers. The law is coming. It's only a matter of time. We hope so. We hope Oregon gets to be a part of that and plays an instrumental role. We stand by to help you refine the law however you want to refine it. But we've got to do something. From a moral point of view, I was listening to the testimony regarding the other bills. This is a matter of fairness. It's absolutely wrong to allow this level of mistreatment to happen in the workplace. We've said no to child abuse. We took forever to say no to domestic violence. Bullying is domestic violence where the abuser's on the payroll. The pathology is the same, the interaction between the two, and the inactivity and the inaction of the witnesses is the same. So what you have now is, and we said, look how long we said, school bullying is nothing more than a rite of passage. We finally said no to that. Now we're in the workplace, we say no to homicide. Well, that's an easy one. That's criminalized. Are we ready to take on psychological violence and say now no to this? This is the last traumatizing taboo that we actually consider to be routine conduct in the U.S. Thank you.
Thank you. Cal?
Thank you. Now that you've heard some statistical data regarding the bill, thank you so much for allowing us to share that today. I'm Cal Robertson, and I'm a member of the Oregon Healthy Workplace Group. I live in Portland, Oregon. And I'm here to ask your support for Senate Bill 1035. You've heard some definitions regarding bullying in the workplace, but I'm asking that the Senate Bill 1035, bullying in the workplace, be made into law so that no other Oregonian will have to suffer the denigration and loss of health that I have for the last 17 years. And more severely, the last 7 years. Didn't expect that. Bullying is a persistent verbal or physical act against an employee that tends to humiliate and is hostile and intimidating and very offensive and degrading the individual's work. Bullying is very traumatic. I sit here representing many of our group who are unable to be here because they are unhealthy. They're not healthy enough to be here. And I have my nitroglycerin in my pocket. Okay. How has bullying affected me? After 17 years of intense, constant nitpicking, fault-finding, criticism of trivial nature, constant refusal to acknowledge my contribution and achievements, constant attempt to undermine my competence, decrease my authority while increasing responsibility, being excluded from appropriate meetings related to my work, not being given correct information to prepare for a meeting with the president and other CEOs.
Excuse me, now we have to stop and change tapes.
Okay. Higher education. I gave the presentation, not realizing I was not given the information that was requested, and my president had to come to my rescue by saying, Cal has not been given correct information to prepare for this meeting because I know her work ethics. Sorry.
Okay, take your time.
I'm supposed to be the strong one in the group.
It's taken many, many years to get to this time and place and opportunity for Cal Robertson to speak and to share her story. And just take the time that you need. Know that we are here to listen.
Thank you. Because I've worked with the president on a number of occasions, he knew that I would get the work done if it took for a very long time. So he was there to defend me while my immediate supervisor was out of the state, and he deliberately led me in the wrong direction. Being set up for failure only to succeed beyond my own expectations, being given authority to make decisions and having those authorities usurped without foundation. Being told you are a lie, not liar, in the presence of my colleagues and other staff members. Having job promotions blocked. Being told by my immediate supervisor that my services were no longer needed because of the change in my marital status. I became divorced. Being humiliated in front of others, for an example, requesting a particular report because my supervisor didn't know what he was asking for, but asked that I get the report done. And I got it done, turned it in, and in front of my colleagues who tried to tell him that the report that he was requesting had nothing to do with what we were working on. And he said, and I quote, "That is not what I told you to do. Now go get it right." Which came with an unrealistic timeline, only to discover that the report that he was requesting was not required. Being told each time I had to go to the bathroom, that I had to tell my supervisor before I left and report to her when I returned. I was required to inform my supervisor when I was out of the office for work-related meetings. I had to call back to the office to say, I'm here, and I had to meet with her or call her when I returned. If she was not in, I had to report to the administrative assistant. Mind you, I'm a manager. Being told that my job security was based on me reporting back to her everything that people said about her because the staff felt comfortable talking to me. Having my clerical support removed from my position and department after learning I was not a production typist. For an example, I was given 8 hours of clerical support per week to support an entire district that I worked in. And only if someone had the time, they would give me support. No one really had the time. Being creative and determined to be successful, I learned to type really fast, meaning in a short period of time. Not real fast, but a short period of time. As a result, I developed, I damaged the nerves in my hands and had to have surgery. While in my doctor's office to have the stitches removed, my doctor said, wait here. I overheard him say, ER stat. I was taken to the emergency room where it was thought that I was having a heart attack. The doctor wanted to send me home for a few days, but I told him I had to call my supervisor first. And knowing she wouldn't believe me, he asked his nurse to do it. And when the nurse called my supervisor, she said to my supervisor that Cal is an emergency. We think she might be having a heart attack. We thought she was having a heart attack, but what it is, she really needs to go home because it's too much stress on her. My supervisor's response was, I don't believe you. You're probably one of her friends. Pretending. My doctor then took over the phone call and spoke to her very firmly that this woman is suffering and she needs to go home. I was reprimanded for becoming ill. And while I was away, thank you, my supervisor instructed the staff to move my office without discussing any of this with me to another location in the building. While I had a nice size office that I could entertain clients or work with clients, I was moved to a 5x7 on the second floor where there was no restroom. And by this time, I had developed a spastic colon. When it was finally determined that medically this was not a good working environment for me, she said for me to go over to another department which was failing. It was about to be closed down because it was a technical program. Let's send her over there because she will fail and be gone. The president cleaned it up by saying, Cal, go over and clean up that program or shut it down. And I report to you today, it is the highest performing program in the United States. For several years, I had some wonderful supervisors who respected my creativity, competence, and ability to get things done. Then came reorganization, new administrators, and as fate would have it, I encountered another bully. Under this new person, I was told after he read some of the things I'd done, I don't believe you're doing all the successful things that you say you are. And I was accused of not spending the budget appropriately, even to the point of suggesting that I was inappropriating funds. Granted, I was given $130,000 to run a particular program that included the secretary, the staff, and myself. Today, that budget is now over $1 million for that particular program. It is now one of the strongest programs in the state of Oregon. While in the middle of hiring a new staff member, My supervisor took the funding that had been earmarked for my new staff member and gave it to another manager who had, without approval, spent more money than she was supposed to. So while I'm interviewing, my budget goes to her. Unfortunately, or fortunately, rather, we were unable to hire the person. We didn't find the skill sets we needed. So that saved the embarrassment of the institution.
Calcul-
I'm going to skip down a little bit.
If so you could wrap it up, we only have about 15 minutes left in the hearing, and we have lots of people.
What I want to share with you, as a result of 17 years of this kind of abuse, I went to the hospital with a 125 blood pressure, which caused me to go in. The medication they gave me caused me to go into deep depression, and for 5 years I've had to take Celexa. Which ultimately, causes me to have memory loss and so forth. I've had several minor strokes. I have had several minor heart attacks. And I still suffer sometimes from short-term memory. Just recently, I had surgery about 3 months ago for stress-related illnesses. I plead to you to pass this bill, not so much so that no other Oregonian would have to endure the psychological abuse in the workplace that I have. I plead for you to pass it not for myself or the Oregon Healthy Workplace Group, but for my children and my grandchildren and your children and grandchildren. I plead for this bill so that current and future Oregonians can feel excited about going to work and performing their jobs that they enjoy, rather than dreading to go to work because work hurts. Thank you.
Thank you. Carol?
Members of the committee, my name is Carol Patton, and I am an active committee member of the Oregon Healthy Workforce Group, and I support Measure Senate Bill 1035 being heard today, which will create an unlawful employment practice of bullying in the workplace. In the year 2001, I was hired as a human resource administrative high-level secretary for one of the state's largest nonprofit medical providers. And my responsibilities included the coordinating and tracking of over 8,000 employees through our education classes. And I always felt that I made a strong effort into relaying these positive and therapeutic classes to other employees, such as service inside out, caring for members and others, communicating for results, using emotional intelligence. 2 years into my HR position, two new secretaries and a new supervisor started working in the education department. Immediately, one of the new hires said she wanted my job because I worked with higher brass. Soon files were being taken without my knowledge. I was left out of departmental meetings and verbally abused literally on a daily basis. I was daily blamed for errors. Daily I was given unreasonable job demands. There was inconsistent use of rules. What was good for somebody else didn't pertain to me. I was excluded, iced out from the department, basically. I tried to deny at first what was happening to me at work. I just felt that the history of my competent work would kind of speak for itself, and this would kind of like blow over, but it just, instead of getting better, it just got worse, and I got worn down, and I got extremely depressed. And by March 2003, I saw a psychiatrist. And then from there, I just realized that the insults and put downs by these women would not end. My supervisor's failure, literally failure to intervene in my behalf. I asked him, I had asked for a meeting with him. I asked if we could have a meeting together as a group to start teamwork up once again and to stop this toxic work environment. And he basically said, "You brought it on yourself. And I expect 100% accuracy from you." And one day, I was so upset over another incident, I just got it from my desk and left, which is absolutely unheard of. Yeah, just got up, didn't tell anybody, left, and never went back to work. And I went on medical disability. I was in an emergency center, and they sent, to my department slips saying that I was unable to work due to stress, anxiety attacks, depressed. I was depressed. I was exhausted. I couldn't concentrate. I couldn't sleep. And what was ironic about it is they actually had the nerve, labor management had the nerve to call my house and harass me and ask me to relinquish my job. And I was on, a disability leave. But that's what they would do. They'd literally call my home. So I'm going to make this brief. I ask for your support of Senate Bill 1035 for the people of the state of Oregon to provide legal remedies for employees like myself and Cal and others who've been harmed by abusive work environment and make employees responsible for the prevention of abuse to employees, because we are not disgruntled employees. This was not a personality conflict. A very amiable, good person to get along with. I didn't even know what was happening to me until it was too late. And thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions?
Mr. Chair, I would just like to say to both Ms. Robertson and Ms. Patton, thank you for coming forward. It takes a lot of courage to come into a setting like this and share such personal information and details about your experiences. And I, for one, commend you and thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, next we have Brett Cody, Deborah Harris, and Denise Peterson. And if you could all come forward and keep it brief, we have about 10 minutes left, and we have three more people after you that would like to talk to us about this bill. So if you could, just a couple minutes apiece, please. Go ahead, Brett.
Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Brett Cody. I live in Portland. I'm a member of AFT Local 3922, and I'm here to give testimony in support of Senate Bill 1035. I would like to say that I have been abused or harassed, because those things have a legal definition. Those things I can get help for. However, those two words are good tools, but have very narrow applications. I'm here today asking for your help with the bully boss who slips between those two tools, but still inflicts psychological damage upon his victims. I'm asking for your help with our suffering. I think it's an excellent letter, and I'd really like you to read it.
Thank you. We will read it.
Terrific.
Thank you for just summarizing it. Deborah?
Good afternoon, committee, senators. My name is Deborah Harris, and I'm a resident of Multnomah County, Portland, Oregon, Northeast Portland. And I am the face of a targeted person that was a teacher that loved her job, was a two-time National Teacher of the Year, that because I was a whistleblower to my principal, who has since been under investigation by the Oregon Government Standards and Practices Commission, I was targeted by her and ousted out in my 29th year of teaching after 28 years of stellar evaluations. And all I did, my problem was because I loved my ninth grade students, and I was popular with the staff, and I also had a PhD in my field, and that was a threat to my principal. And I became a very vulnerable target for her because I was taking care of my aging father, who was in a nursing home, and I was his only provider. And so she harassed me for about 2 years, and I didn't see it coming, and so I was finally ousted out in my 29th year. I was able to survive with some remuneration because of the fact that I had some information that was credible to my case. And since I had been working at Portland State University for the last 10 years in the evening, teaching classes to undergraduates and graduates in the summer, I was hired on as a part-time instructor. And since then, I have been researching emotional abuse in the workplace and now offer a seminar in the summer for undergraduate and graduates, because I feel like my voice can educate others. And I don't want any other Oregonian ever to suffer how I suffered because I loved my job. And and now it's so compelling when I see the research, when I have done the research to provide for my seminar participants, that it's the same phenomena. These people have the same characteristics. And the stories I've heard, like Gary has heard, are incredible. And it's very, teachers have come to me after I was targeted and ousted, a 25-year secretary in the same school, the gun was turned on her, and she was ousted. And this, it's the same kind of thing over and over and over. And it's real. There's a face to it. And these people are afraid to even come forward because it's damaged their lives so much they're embarrassed because they think that they've been responsible. So I please, please beg of you, as a 54-year resident of Portland, Oregon, and an Oregonian, I beg that you support this bill and pass this, because this will continue and continue, and more people will be devastated. And it's not just the individuals. It's their families, their friends, and everyone that's around them. Thank you.
Thank you. And Denise.
Good afternoon. My name is Denise Peterson. Thank you, Vice Chair Beyer and committee members, for giving me the opportunity to testify regarding Senate Bill 1035, referred to as the bullying bill. The serial bully is often in a position of power that has high administrative authority. The serial bully's behavior is an adult that acts emotionally retarded, that has childlike behavior in a professional environment. The bully is unwilling to accept responsibilities as an adult. When you challenge the bully regarding their behavior, they deny everything and play the victim role. Their behavior is one of a Jekyll and Hyde nature, meaning vile, vicious, and vindictive in private, but innocent and charming in front of witnesses. No one can or wants to believe this individual has a vindictive nature. Only the target of the serial bully's aggression sees both sides, while the Jekyll side is described as charming and convincing enough to deceive personnel and management. The Hyde is the real person. For the bully, it is about control, domination, and intimidation. I am and have been a victim of bullying tactics and subjected to a hostile work environment in various capacities. In the workplace, this has caused duress, headaches, and many visits to the doctor, high medical bills, sick time, and stress to the family, job sabotage, and job loss. This is the 21st century, and no one should have to work under these circumstances in order to lead a normal life. I term bullying as a silent killer. This bullying kills dreams, influence, inspiration, and aspirations. Time out for such senseless behavior in the 21st century. Employers should be held accountable for bullying bosses and co-workers' behavior. I am asking Vice Chair Beyer and committee members that you pass Senate Bill 1035 out of committee so that no Oregonian should have to suffer and go through undue duress or hardship in the workplace. Once again, thank you, Vice Chair Beyer and committee members, for allowing me to have this opportunity to testify before you today, because the stories that I have to tell would be too numerous and too many.
Thank you very much. Any questions?
I would just like to say, to acknowledge that Ms. Peterson formerly served as my executive assistant for two sessions of the Legislative Assembly, and she currently serves as a community liaison. It's good to see you today. Thank you for the courage, all of you, for your courage in coming forward. And to the doctor, thank you for your service as an educator in the state of Oregon. Thank you all for coming forward.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Lisa Tressel. And then we also have, I think it's Michelle Suffian. And Marshall O'Miller. We're going to be done. Lisa, if you could go first.
Okay.
And then we have about 5 minutes before we run out of tape. And then we also need to end the hearing because there's another committee coming in here. So,
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lisa Trussell with Associated Oregon Industries, and I grabbed the wrong packet when I walked up here. But just to summarize, we have some concerns with the language in the bill. There's some vague terms, reasonable. There's several on the first page and a couple going into the second page that we're not sure how those would be defined. And the way they're written now, an unintended consequence would be when you were doing a standardized employee improvement, performance improvement plan that could be interpreted to be causing stress. And I'd also like to note that the workers' comp statutes allow for benefits for workers who have suffered stress that's beyond the normal expectation for the job. But just in summary, if the bill was going forward, we'd have some concerns with some of the terms that are used in it for the descriptions. They could, if it is going forward, I think they need to be a little bit better defined.
One question, please.
Senator Bakke.
Thank you. Ms. Trussell, I'm guessing on Section 2 on the first page where it says that any of these actions need to be unrelated to the employer's legitimate business interest, that would help suffice for, you know, help soothe part of the trouble you have with this.
Correct.
With the example that you just gave, for instance, that would be a legitimate business interest.
Correct.
Okay. Any questions? Thank you very much. We'll probably have a couple minutes is all, and the tape's going to go out, and we have to stop, so please.
I'm Michelle Sefian Chilton. I'm going to dispense with the niceties. I have been a victim of this type of abuse. If you will review the terms, it caught in the crosshairs, under the gun, targeted. I was repeatedly told to fly under the radar. These are all war terms. When you are targeted by a bully boss, you are literally on the battlefield being shot at all the time. I was terminated. It took them a year. I was specifically and repeatedly told it was not because of my work, because my work was of the highest quality. I have a written a statement that I believe Senator Gordley's office has already made copies of and provided to all the members of the Senate. I urge you to read it and to pull up the documents that I refer to in my short missive to Senator Gordley, who I appreciate and thanks so much for sponsoring this bill.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And
Marsha,
we're out of time, so if it comes back, we'll have your name on the list to be able to hear.
And before the gavel goes down, let me confirm with staff. Has this hearing been on videotape?
It has been broadcasted live, and it has been on the board.
Okay. I wanted to make sure that those who came to testify today understood that this hearing has been live. It has been broadcast in the building. It has been broadcast on the Internet as well. And the broadcast is available to many, many people in the state. So this has been an opportunity to educate, to educate, to educate. Lastly, to my colleagues, my friend, the senator from Malala, and to Senator Avakian, I ask for your help in talking to members of your caucuses, please, about this bill and what you heard today. I'm going to need your assistance getting this bill through the process, and I'm asking for your assistance getting the bill through the process this afternoon. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone, and we are closing the hearing, and we are adjourned.